Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the July 24th, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, strap yourselves in, folks. Make sure the hold-down posts are securely bolted, and don't let go, because this is a more power edition of Space Talk, as today we are going to talk about propulsion, about the power it takes to get from here to there, whether you are in the air or are in space. It's a more power edition today. We'll get into that a little bit while here, but as we do move along, you are invited to join us as always today on the program by giving us a call at 321-768-1240 from anywhere you are. Local AT&T wireless customers, you can dial *1240 on your device and make a free phone call to get into the studio. Or again, from anywhere, just send us an email, the address spacetalking@aol.com. Well, again, before we do get into that discussion about powering tomorrow's airplanes and rockets, I want to take a few moments to recognize a major historical milestone in our space program. Not so much for what was launched 60 years ago today, but for where it was launched from. At 9:28 a.m. Eastern Time on July 24th, 1950, exactly 60 years ago this morning, the very first rocket launched from Cape Canaveral. It was called Bumper 8, and it lifted off from Launch Complex 3 of the newly established Joint Long-Range Proving Ground, which, of course, today we do call Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. This was Bumper 8. The first six bumper launches had taken place in White Sands, New Mexico. But as the missile range there wasn't very big and our rockets were getting more powerful, plans for new missiles on the drawing boards were going to require more room to fly. The government started looking for another place to launch from. And in 1947, they got additional proof that additional impetus that they needed to find someone somewhere new to fly when one of the captured German V-2 rockets lifted off from White Sands. And instead of flying north, as it was supposed to, it headed south, much to the surprise of everybody on the range. The rocket overflew El Paso, Texas, went right over the border without any problems there, and crashed into a Mexican cemetery. That was quite an eye-opening experience for everyone. And so they started debating and discussing amongst themselves where they might fly from in the future. And by 1949, the government had settled on making the east coast of Florida the new launch site. And so the bumper team packed up their gear and two more rockets and moved across country. Now, the bumper was a two-stage rocket. It was made up of a German V-2 rocket, first stage, and what's called a WAC Corporal sounding rocket that was developed by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory long before JPL had anything to do with NASA. That WAC Corporal served as the upper stage. Now, the purposes of the launch, you think of Cape Canaveral as a place to launch into space. Well, of course, in the early days, it was not necessarily a space launch. It was all about developing missiles, using rockets as weapons. So the purpose of this bumper launch, of course, was not to reach space, not even to go into orbit. Instead, this series of missions flew more of a flat, kind of horizontal path through the atmosphere to test the ability of a missile to fly in stages as it streaked toward its target. Now, back then, of course, it wasn't clear if a two-stage rocket would even work. Could the two pieces separate cleanly? How would the second stage react when it fired its engine after being boosted so high and so fast by the first stage. Of course, today we take all of this for granted, but back then those were fundamental problems, fundamental research, only theories, no answers. They had to have the direct application. They had to test fly it to make sure it would work. There were such basic questions. I mean, I always like to point out the fact that, like, when John Glenn, for example, first orbited the Earth in 1962, and he was going to be weightless for several hours, there were serious professional medical doctors, experts who questioned whether or not even Glenn would be able to swallow in space, whether his eyes would even work, whether his blood would know where to flow, whether his heart would know how to beat in the weightless zero microgravity. So we had to figure those things out back in 1950 as they were getting ready to fly from the Cape for the first time. They first stacked bumper 7. There were 8 bumpers. Bumper 8 flew, and then bumper 7 flew, and it's kind of out of order, but that's because when they tried to fly bumper 7 during the final countdown, the rocket was all fueled up, and a valve on the rocket froze. They were using alcohol and liquid oxygen as the propellant for the first stage, and this valve froze, and they couldn't budge it open, and it basically scrubbed the launch. And they tried to figure out what to do, and they decided that they would take the Bumper 7 rocket down and put the Bumper 8 rocket up and fly that first instead. And it took about 2 weeks between the one scrub and then when they were ready to fly Bumper 8. Now, fortunately, everything worked as planned with the Bumper 8 mission. Well, at least almost everything, depending on how you want to look at it. The V2 rocket did successfully lift off and flew as expected. When its engines shut down and it was time for staging, the WAC Corporal separated as planned and ignited its own engine to continue the flight. But almost immediately after that, contact with that upper stage was lost, and folks generally believe that it basically broke up and fell into the ocean. So while some history books declared that first launch from the Cape a failure, as I did in the story I wrote 10 years ago for Space.com, it's probably more accurate to say that although the Bumper 8 did not achieve all of its objectives, the major goals of the mission having to do with the launch itself and the staging of the two rockets was a complete success. So now, of course, behind that story, the main story of the launch itself, are so many other incredible, wonderful stories involving the people who made this happen and how the decision to the launch from the Cape was first decided, the working and living conditions that they endured, what the Space Coast was like in 1950. Most of what I know about Bumper 8 and those earliest days of life at the Cape, I learned from an incredibly friendly and generous man who was the very first fire chief at the Cape, Norris Gray. And we lost Norris just almost a year ago here, July of last year, about 6 days from now, in fact, the first anniversary of his passing. Norris had a lot of tales to tell. He loved to talk about all the missiles and the rockets that he owned as fire chief because the launch director would tell him that if anything went wrong with the missile on the pad, it was all Norris's. So he loved that. He loved talking about the story about the woman that refused to leave her home when they were getting ready to launch Bumper. There were still some homes out there when the government moved in to do the rocket launches. And this one woman had threatened she would not leave. She had a shotgun. She was pointing at the people trying to make her leave. And Norris had visited her the day before to talk her into leaving, and he noticed that the gun was blocked up, but it was capped. It was plugged. And so it really wasn't going to work. So the next day when it was time to launch Bumper and they had to clear her out and she threatened with the gun, Norris went right in ahead of everybody else, picked her up, threw her over his shoulder, walked out and carried her out into the safety zone all by himself. Now, can you imagine that? I mean, that's just incredible. So, of course, the Bumper 8, it may not be that big of a deal nationally, but it's certainly important for us here at the Cape. It set the stage for everything that came after. I mean, weather, communication, navigation satellites into Earth orbit, probes to the moon and to the other planets, and of course, human spaceflight. That paved the way for landing men on the moon. So to all of us on the Space Coast, congratulations. Happy anniversary to us and a way to go. So we'll be back in just a minute. We're going to carry on, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB.
Back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And again, welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. As we begin our discussion about aviation and space propulsion of the future, I want to remind you all that our phone lines are open at 321-768-1240 for your calls. If you have any questions about propulsion, about the bumper launch anniversary, or even anything having to do with space flight, we welcome your calls. And, of course, your email, always welcome at spacetalking@aol.com. Well, this next week in Nashville, Music City, USA, the AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, will be managing its annual Joint Propulsion Conference. Actually, several organizations coming together, including NASA, to discuss the future of propulsion. And I'm pleased to say that I will be attending each day during the conference. They expect some of the nation's best scientists and engineers to present their ideas on how to improve technology that we need, again, to get from here to there, again, whether it is from space or in the air. And the technical chairman of the conference is a gentleman named Dr. Lance Chenault, who is currently a member of the Aerospace Business Development Associates in Dayton, Ohio. He has a long and distinguished career in aerospace with experience in a variety of technical areas, engine instrumentation, fluid dynamics, propulsion simulation, and much more. Now, let's put it this way. This guy knows his stuff, and he's on the phone with us. From Dayton, Ohio, I guess. Dr. Lance Chenault, welcome to Space Talk. It's great to have you with us.
Yes, thank you, Jim.
Good. Hey, well, let's before we talk about the conference and AIAA and all that stuff, let's talk a little bit about you, because we don't know who you are. Talk about your background and what motivates you to pursue aviation and space and all of these incredible areas.
Well, I've been in the aerospace industry for about 30 years now, and I remember growing up watching the Apollo launches, and it's very, very appropriate that this is conversation taking place on the 60th anniversary of some of NASA's initial launches. Watching the moon launches was just a very inspirational thing for me, and wanted to be part of the aerospace community almost my entire life.
Yeah. That's a familiar ring around here, that's for sure. Did you ever have to stay home to watch space launches or anything like that?
No, I never had to stay home to do that. No.
Okay, great. Oh, okay, so you're following this path and you're in career. What are some of the things you've worked on that we might know about?
Well, I worked on some of the hypersonic vehicles that you've probably heard about with AFRL and NASA. In the mid 90s, AFRL was doing a lot of partnering with the Russians, and one of the projects that I worked on was called the Ajax scramjet, and got to see that fly. I did some work on the ballistic missile systems. In fact, I was one of the engineers on a laser ordnance firing system that is used to ignite the rocket motors on the missiles.
Oh, really? Cool.
And I did some re-engineering work on the C-17.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And I think generally speaking, you've been doing mostly atmospheric stuff as opposed to orbital stuff.
That's correct. Yeah, it's almost all been limited to within the domain of the atmosphere.
Okay, interesting. Okay, well, now let's talk about let's get into it by talking about AIAA first, American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And by the way, if you ever want to know which A comes first, it's always the aeronautics first, then astronautics, because the aviation came before space. That's how you remember it. But talk about AIAA. What kind of an organization is it? Who makes it up, and how important is it?
Well, AIAA has about 30,000 members worldwide. It's made up of folks who are students in the schools, their professors, the folks that go off into industry to actually implement the science and technology that's developed at universities and the research institutes. And there's also a very large contingent of industry leadership involved in AIAA, and we even have some of the highest levels of the government and military involved in AIAA. In fact, one of the previous AIAA presidents, Paul Nielsen, was the Major General Paul Nielsen, was the commander of AFRL, And we currently have Dr. Mark Lewis as the AIAA president, who was the chief scientist of the Air Force just 2 years ago.
Yeah, and when you think about the engineers who do the real grunt work in making our in advancing our technology in aviation and space, I mean, truly, this is your, I don't want to say it's your social organization, but it's your professional organization. I mean, when you come to these conferences, you just don't sit and present papers. Of course, that's what you do. But, I mean, the real decisions, the real collaboration is really facilitated by what AIAA does.
Absolutely. You know, as you say, it's not just a place where you go to present papers. This is the professional networking society for the aerospace industry.
Yeah, and in that regard, it's not just propulsion. I mean, talk about the conferences. Of course, you're the technical chairman of the propulsion conference, but this is one of how many conferences does AIAA sponsor and work on?
You know, I don't have the exact number, but I believe it's somewhere around 24 conferences or disciplines that AIAA sponsors. AIAA is involved in, obviously, propulsion, atmospheric and space, nuclear. They're involved in fluid dynamics, in structures, materials, avionics, sensors, instrumentation, public policy. And if you just go to their website at AIAA.org, you can see a list of all the disciplines that AIAA sponsors. It's a really amazing list.
Yeah, I mean it's everything really from A to Z. Now, of course, the Joint Propulsion Conference is what we're focusing on today, and talk about the kind of people that are going to be there. What are they studying? What are their disciplines? What are they involved with?
Well, the Joint Propulsion Conference is more for the practicing engineer than it is for the academician and the researcher. So you're going to see a lot of people who are actually out there in the field, doing hands-on engineering, making modifications to aircraft or spacecraft, actually putting things up in the air.
Okay, and we talked about presenting papers. So talk about, you know, as a technical chairman. You're kind of coordinating all that. I mean, are you selecting the papers? I'm sure you have a team that does that, of course. But
how does that
talk about how that process works? That may be strange to a lot of listeners. This whole idea of papers and presenting and abstracts and all that.
Sure. There's a call for papers that comes out about a year before the conference, and they ask the people who have concepts to submit abstracts of about 1,000 words, defining what the paper's about. Once we get the pool of abstracts into our database, I have a team of folks that will distribute the abstracts to people in the various disciplines to review and certify that these are legitimate physics-based concepts and results that are relevant to advancing the state of the art in our discipline.
And then they send in the abstract. You decide which ones are going to be good papers. They write the papers. They submit them, and then they're invited to present. Is that how it works?
Yes.
Okay. Well, and then how many papers and what's the highlights? Well, let's not get into the specifics yet, but tell me about how many presenters are going to be. What's the scope of this conference?
Well, we have 160 sessions that are going to be going on over 3 days. There's going to be approximately 560 papers that will be presented over the course of the 3 days. And then we have various keynote speakers and special sessions that are going to be going on during the 3 days.
Okay, and exhibits as well.
We have a lot of exhibitors who are coming. I believe there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 70 exhibitors. I haven't seen the list lately, so I'm not sure how many are there. But yes, we have a large number of exhibitors that come from industry and other institutions that support AIAA.
Yeah, that's amazing. We're gonna take a quick phone call here on a space topic, Lance, and then we're going to pause for our five-minute hold. So just stand by for a minute. I want to talk to Reggie from Melbourne. Reggie, welcome to Space Talk.
Thank you. Just a little bit off the subject, more on history.
No, that's fine.
I remember when Cape Canaveral was redesignated as Cape Kennedy, and then it went back. I never understood how that happened. It seemed to me if you named a national institution after a deceased president, you had it forever, like Fort Hood or Fort McClellan or something mm-hmm. like that.
Well, I can give you a little – thanks, Reggie, and I'll give you a little taste of the history of that real quick here. It was the Launch Operations Center for NASA in 1962 when it officially started. And you had Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, you had the geographic region called Cape Canaveral, the geographic feature called Cape Canaveral, the city of Cape Canaveral. That's truly its history. When the president was assassinated, literally a week later, Lyndon Johnson got on the air and said, we're gonna basically rename everything. And so that was when the Kennedy Space Center was created. And then they renamed Cape Canaveral Cape Kennedy. That lasted about 10 years. And over the course of those 10 years, the local folks here just really, you know, everyone appreciated the Kennedy Space Center, but thought it may have gone a little overboard in naming everything Cape Kennedy when the historical nature of the thing was so well ingrained and so part of the culture around here. So in 1973, working with all the appropriate authorities, they changed the name back to Cape Canaveral. So you still had the Kennedy Space Center honoring the fallen president, but then you had the other names going back to the historically more accepted names of Cape Canaveral. And it's always kind of fun because as you're talking to guys, you can tell what era they're from by whether they call this place Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy. So that's the quick little history lesson. We are going to take our 5-minute pause. Be back with more with Dr. Lance Chenault and the IAA after this break. This is Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
Welcome back to this second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, the annual AIAA Joint Propulsion Conference is in Nashville this week. My guest today with us on the phone, technical chairman of that event, Dr. Lance Chenault. And before we get into a discussion about some of the specific topics that are going to be addressed during this conference, I want to take a moment and remind everyone listening that you can stay in touch with Space Talk between shows by visiting the website at WMMBAM.com. There you can check out our Space Talk page, listen to whatever is on the air right at the moment in real time by streaming audio. You can download a podcast of the most recent Space Talk. By the way, today's show available as it always is each week by tomorrow morning. Or even sign up for a special WMMB cruise in November on which I and my wife Dawn will be participating. It will be my first ever cruise, so if you want to have some real fun, sign up, come on board, and watch me make all of the classic rookie mistakes that first-time cruisers make. And I don't even know what they are, but I'm sure it will be entertaining. Well, in any case, be sure and check it all out, WMMBAM.com. Well, Dr. Chenault, again, thanks for being with us today and looking at the program, looking at the agenda, looking at the brochure and kind of the way this whole conference this year was pitched and presented. It seems like the whole idea of green, again, is kind of a running theme throughout the program. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of green space and green aviation?
Sure. There's inefficiencies in every mechanical system, whether it be aerodynamic or chemical, or just mechanical. There's inefficiencies that we're trying to address in terms of propulsion, especially with the air breathing systems. There's so much air traffic that goes on around the world. If we can reduce the exhaust the pollutants that come out of any internal combustion type engine, it would be an advantage to the Earth and this country as a whole. So we're looking at ways to improve combustion. We're also looking at ways to improve the or lessen the footprint that manufacturing processes employ in terms of the chemicals that are used for the rockets and the air breathing engines. If we're going to have several sessions on the third day, Wednesday, devoted to alternative fuels that are being developed by the Air Force on how to try and lessen the dependency on fossil fuels that the Air Force uses.
Now, I know on the aviation side, and because of the work I do with NASA Aeronautics, I'm learning a lot about this all the time. You know, you'd think just as in general, you know, that jet engines, they've been around forever, relatively speaking. With every new administration, with every new more environmentally enlightened culture that we become, it seems like the engines are getting quieter. And you just wonder how far you can push these things to be as fuel efficient, to be not as noisy, to not put out as much emissions as they can. And then, of course, that's what green aviation is all about. I mean, do you have an idea of how far you can keep pushing the technology? Are there still new ideas, new materials to be invented?
Oh, absolutely. And if I could tell you what they were, I'd already have them on the market.
Right. And so that's the basic research, and that's the whole process, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow. So and also in aviation, I just want to get a feel for this now. The idea of supersonics, of course, you know, was a big deal in the 70s. We had our own version. You had the Concorde for many years. You can argue whether or not that was a financial success or not, but certainly from an environmental standpoint, you know, it has some issues. And certainly in America, we don't want to fly sonic booms over land was the big concern. I know working with the NASA folks, that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on trying to reduce that sonic footprint. Do you see that from where you sit as a real possibility someday? Are we going to be in supersonic jets? Or are we going to skip supersonic jets and go right to hypersonic suborbital point-to-point flight?
I think you're going to see supersonic jets sometime in the future. I don't think that will be skipped over. There's too many material challenges that still face commercialization of a hypersonic vehicle. I think it's going to be an incremental leap from subsonic to supersonic to the hypersonic community, but I believe, you know, I firmly believe that the jump will be made to both those regimes, and you will see commercial supersonic flight sometime in the future.
Well, talk a little bit more about alternative fuels as well. I mean, we're not just talking ethanol in the avgas. I mean, you're talking about what, biofuels, growing stuff, making stuff out of soybeans and corn, or I've even heard algae being discussed.
You know, algae is surprisingly, algae is one of the most energy compact substances you'll find on the earth. And Bill Harrison, who is the technical advisor for fuels and energy at AFRL, has been is really leading the charge for the Air Force on how to take advantage of these synthetic and alternative fuels. I understand you're going to be at the conference, so please stop right in and attend that session. And following his presentation, we're going to have some researchers chaired by Dilip Bilal from the University of Dayton who are going to give even more in-depth discussion on these alternative fuels in terms of progress, challenges, and the directions that they're going.
And are these fuels pure new fuels, I mean, with a whole new designation, JP, whatever, or are they additives to thin out the oil a bit, to thin out the reliance on oil?
You know, I really can't address that. I don't know enough about it to say if it's going to be a new designation or not. I'm sure it would have to be, because it's not going to be JP-8. It's going to be JP something else.
But what I don't mean to get hung up on the designation. What I meant by that was what, you know, are these, you know, if you take algae and make something out of it, are you blending that with petroleum-based products already, or is it a whole new liquid that we're using as a fuel?
It's a whole new liquid that's being used as a fuel, and from my understanding of the process is that they can make synthetic JP-8, JP-10, depending upon what the synthesization process is that they use.
Now, have you, and speaking of alternative fuels, have you heard anything about using electricity to do basically a big fan, not necessarily a jet with jet propulsion, but electricity turning the large fans to propel aircraft? Have you heard anything like that being worked on?
You know, I haven't heard that one. It could be true. I just haven't heard of it.
Okay. I wondered about that, because I think I've come across that a little bit myself in a thought it was kind of weird and didn't know if that was one of the topics that would be discussed.
It would seem that to me that that would be an unlikely top method of propulsion, because you still have to have some way to generate electricity, and combustion is still one of the most efficient, if not the most efficient, method to generate power.
It seems that way. Well, let's jump up a few miles and talk about spaceflight. When you mentioned green space, you know, I was trying to think for the life of me, how do you make outer space less polluted, you know, with green? But you're talking about the manufacturing processes. You're talking about creating new rocket engines and building new spacecraft, but by doing it with more environmentally friendly means on the ground. Is that what I heard?
That's certainly one of the aspects, and also, you know, getting the fuels up into space is a big challenge. You know, nuclear space flight is the nuclear generators are really quite efficient in terms of powering long term, you know, very long duration missions. But there's the issue of getting the spacecraft up into orbit safely. In case there's mishaps during the launch that have to be addressed and are currently being addressed. And one of the things that we're trying to find out is how we can be even more efficient with respect to that.
Mm. Now, moving away from the green and just talking about exotic new space propulsion, and I'm going to reference a column by the AIAA chairman, Bob Dickman, former 45th Space Wing commander here, in this month's Aerospace America, which is the AIAA monthly journal. You know, he was talking about the future of space propulsion, not sure what it would look like. He says, but I'm sure it won't be pointy end up, goes up, fire comes out the bottom. You know, some kind of new exotic thing that takes us beyond chemical and you know, to do some really exotic acceleration, constant acceleration, even at 1/10 of 1G constant acceleration, go halfway to Mars, turn around, brake all the way down into Mars, and you could turn a six-month journey into like a 3-week visit. Are these some of the kind of things that will be discussed at the conference?
I would expect you would see something like that. That what you're describing falls into the realm of electric propulsion and ion propulsion and technology of that nature. And we have, I think we have somewhere along the lines of 32 sessions with 3 to 5 papers per session being presented over the course of this conference on those topics.
It really seems to be the future. You're talking about the ion thrusters being demonstrated now. Of course, you're not talking about warp drive yet either, are we?
No, we're not talking about things that violate physics just yet.
I'm sure we'll get there, and I'm sure we'll talk about it around the lounge in the evening. Dr. Chenault, thanks. We're out of time with you for today. Appreciate it. We will see you in a couple of days, and thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Jim. Thank you.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Good. Well, we'll see you soon. Well, we'll be back in the moment with the final segment, some updates on what's going on, and a little surprise visit from a guy that had a really good day yesterday. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to WMMB. Back in a moment.
This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Well, we talked earlier in the program about the Bumper 8 launch, the anniversary 60 years ago today of the very first rocket launch from Cape Canaveral. And yesterday at the actual launch site, Complex 3 out at the almost the tip of the Cape there, near the lighthouse. The Air Force staged a nice small ceremony to commemorate the event, and I was honored and pleased to be the featured speaker there. We had a really good morning and a nice turnout, and it was really a nice gesture to do that. And in any case, that morning ceremony was the first of two significant events for the 45th Space Wing yesterday. During the afternoon, the current commander of the 45th since this past February, Ed Wilson, was promoted from colonel to brigadier general and earned his star, was pinned. And I am extremely pleased to welcome to Space Talk the U.S. Air Force's newest one-star officer, Brigadier General Ed Wilson. General Wilson, welcome, sir.
Hey, good morning, or good afternoon, Jim. Nice to be aboard.
You bet. And congratulations once again on your promotion. I appreciate you calling in today. I know you had a very busy day yesterday and a lot going on, and I know you're out with your family right now. And what, you were planning to do some diving today? Was that it?
Actually, Jim, we just finished stuff. We just got out of the water. You caught me about an hour ago. We were underwater.
Wow.
We finished up our open water certification. So the whole family did the course together, and we just got our certificates, and we're just catching a quick bite to eat to celebrate.
Oh,
it was a wonderful day.
Well, congratulations. That's great that a space guy would like to explore underwater as well. It must be in your blood.
There you go. Just another adventure.
Just another adventure.
My kids had made a Florida bucket list on the way out from Albuquerque, and this was on the list.
And
so
we
started getting after it.
Oh, that's great. Where do you go to do that?
We're down in Jupiter, actually. And so just a beautiful part of the state. Hadn't been down here before. Ooh. We've really enjoyed the day.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I know we're gonna talk and have some more time together. I think we're shooting for a day in September, we hope, where we're going to have you on the program for the full hour, and we'll get into all the details and the politics and all the future and all that kind of stuff. But for now, we just did want to say hello and welcome and congratulations. And talk about yesterday getting the pin. You know, you've been in space pretty much through your whole career and working your way up through the Air Force. I mean, what's it like? It's hard for a civilian to understand, I think. It's certainly hard for me to understand what kind of a day it must be to get that star actually pinned on your shirt.
It was a real special day, Jim. We had a lot of family and a whole bunch of friends that were out for the event, so it made it really special. You know, I guess the two words that would describe it would be it was very exciting, but it was also very humbling at the same time. Very mixed emotions, but definitely some butterflies. And, I was picking up uniforms the other day at the cleaners or the tailors. You know, we put new rank on some of the camo uniforms or what have you. And
sure.
It hit me then when I was picking them up and I saw my name with the rank, you know, the insignia with the star on it. That's when it really, I think, hit home that, oh, my gosh, this is for real.
Those kind of things. You know, do you get the little flag on your car and they change the license plate on the front and all that? I mean,
they do. The staff's done a wonderful job of getting everything prepped. And so, you know, flags and the notations that go on the car and everything else.
Now,
I went down and got my ID yesterday also.
Well, and I noticed even last night when you sent the email confirming you were going to call, it already had been changed to Brigadier General. I thought that was pretty cool.
Our
pretty
staff was well ahead of the game. They did an outstanding job. They really did. It made the day extra special. So the little things like that just make it so smooth.
That's great. Well, and I know you've been here since February. You've already got a couple launches under your belt. I'm real curious here. To ask you that first time sitting in the chair, you know, you're head of the Eastern Range, you're responsible for the safety of everybody. What was that like to you as the top guy to give that first go for launch?
It was. It was very, very exciting. A little bit of a fish out of water in some regards. You know, I've grown up in space, but I've typically worked mostly on-orbit satellites, and so a lot of on-console time with the on-orbit stuff. And we've done a little bit of launch activity where I came from, but it was small launch, and I wasn't actually sitting in the chair on the ranges. So it was exciting. I tell you what, since February when I came aboard, we've done 12 launches now out of the Eastern Range. So it's been a busy spring and early summer here, but each one's it's been fantastic. It's it'd be lying if we didn't say, you know, you always, your emotions get high. We all stand up and we're watching everything and the count, and it's an exciting time, but the team does a great job. They really do. It's nice to have professionals surrounding you. It makes the job easy. It really does.
Well, you know, yesterday we celebrated the bumper anniversary together, and we talked about the traditions, the legacy that's been left for us by those that came before. Every year, another new generation of workers and leaders taking over. You know, that tradition of excellence, I mean, it really does continue, and I think certainly the way I understand all of us out here, and certainly the Air Force and the military tradition, that tradition is important to you guys, that maintaining that legacy, that professionalism, and carrying on that tradition is a big part of the culture.
Very much so, very much so. You know, especially in the military, I think if you look at any unit, we're very proud of our heritage. And we look back, at, you know, as to where the units come from, and each unit has its own character. They really do. You know, on the Eastern Range, it's renowned for being the busiest range, obviously, in the world. And They do a tremendous quality job. We really do. I've always admired it from a distance, being in Air Force Space Command for many years now, but never had the opportunity to serve in the 45th. So it was a real proud moment when I came aboard. But the team does a magnificent job. They really do.
That's great. We'll let you go in here a second. Now, August 10th, still looking like the next launch from the Cape. An Atlas carrying a brand-new generation of military communication satellites. The importance of the military launches and maintaining our national security gets underplayed a little bit compared to everything else that goes on. That's a big launch for the military, isn't it?
It is. It is. You know, there's been a series really this year and then early next year where we've had, for those that aren't aware, we had the Delta that went just about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago now, and that had a GPS 2F1 satellite, which was a brand new block of new generation, really, of GPS satellites. And that program has been underway for over a decade now, which is amazing. So it's the first and really a big milestone launch for the whole team. And then the AEHF1, which is the Advanced Extremely High Frequency Satellites, it's the new really block for our MilSatCom on the secure communication side. And so that's really another milestone. And then, early next year, mid next year, we'll have the next space-based infrared system coming on board. And that's our missile warning satellite. And that program's been in motion for over a decade. So we really have got a whole series of milestone launches ahead of us, as well as a couple things on the classified side. And, it's up to us to make sure we get all of the launch processing, the satellite vehicle processing, the booster, and the satellite processing completed and make sure the range is ready to go so we can get them all off successfully.
That's great.
But,
well, it's
good. The whole team to do it, that's for sure.
It sure does it. And it's good to get all those PowerPoint slides we've watched for 10 years finally into real hardware and off the ground.
You've got it.
Well, that's
you got
right.
it, Jim.
Well, General Wilson.
To go from that. The PowerPoint magic to a real launch is key.
That's right. Well, we need to say goodbye to you. Get back in the water. Enjoy the rest of the time with your family, and we'll talk to you again real soon, okay?
Sounds great, Jim. Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
Good. Well, and there goes Brigadier General Ed Wilson, and a really nice guy. Well, look, next week on Space Talk, my guest is going to be former Space Shuttle astronaut Jay Abt. A program you won't want to miss. He is really neat, too. And that's it for today. Thanks again for listening. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Mila Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. The Home Mortgage Law Show is next, followed by Dan Connery at 4 p.m. right here on WMMB. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you all again real soon.